And our next argument is McFarland versus Weil. Mr. Goggin?
Good morning. My name is Daniel Goggin. I represent Mr. McFarland, the plaintiff. The trial court in this case, barred Mr. McFarland from pursuing an action. They dismissed his complaint based on the Supreme Court's case in Beck v. Prupus, which simply says the act of firing an employee is not a predicate act nor otherwise wrongful under the RICO statute. Therefore, plaintiff loses.
I have a procedural question I need to get some clarification for. As I understand it, Mr. McFarland sued not only the law firm Brian Cave and the Marshall and Stevens people in the Hogans, but also the lawyer, Mr. Weil.
That's correct.
And looking at Judge Reagan's memorandum in order, he refers twice, actually, once on page 2 of the order and once at the end, to two motions to dismiss, one of which he characterizes filed by defendant M&S, and the other of which he characterizes as filed by Brian Cave and the Hogans. Now, missing from that picture is Mr. Weil. So I want to know, did Mr. Weil file a separate motion that remains unadjudicated, or did the district judge simply fail to indicate that he joined one or the other of those motions? Because I'm concerned about the finality of the judgment here.
Your Honor, I believe the trial court just slipped in its terminology. All the defendants, other than Marshall and Stevens, are represented by the same law firm.
In the record I will see that Mr. Weil joined the motion that the district judge twice describes is from Brian Cave and the three Hogan.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Brothers. Okay.
But
because if that's not the case, then there's no appellate jurisdiction, of course. We would have to at least issue a limited remand to the district court, we'd have to remand the case to the district court to resolve the last defendants.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but it's my recollection all through this that Mr. Weil is being represented by the same attorneys representing Brian Cave and the law firm, and I think if the trial judge left that out in his memorandum, it was just an error. It wasn't anything substantive.
Okay.
You seem to be arguing that McFarland's injury was caused by his employer joining the conspiracy.
That's correct.
But in Beck, the Supreme Court stated that a conspiracy claim is not an independent cause of action, but it's only the mechanism for holding co-conspirators liable when another member of the conspiracy commits a tortious act. So why isn't that the end of the case? I mean, the joining of the conspiracy is not a racketeering act, and the wrongful termination is not a racketeering act under the statute. So what exactly is the racketeering act that caused the injury?
Okay. First, Your Honor, I believe that the Hobbs Act violation that we've alleged in the complaint is a predicate act under the 1961. And the activity was involved, as alleged in the complaint, ultimately led to Mr. McFarland's...
What's the predicate act? I missed that.
It's the Hobbs Act violation. It's under...
I don't see that. Mm-hmm. I don't see extortion here.
Yeah.
I think of extortion as getting property or money or something from, you know, shaking down someone either by threats or by use of official position.
Well, and that's particularly true after the Supreme Court's second decision in Shidler against Now, which tightened up what this court had earlier thought extortion might be, made it very clear that obtaining of property was part of this Hobbs Act violation.
That's correct, but as argued in the brief, our position is that these threats made by Mr. Weil on this phone conference were an attempt to get Mr. McFarland's property, his livelihood, his career as an appraiser. And
why is that? It's easy enough to see the harm to Mr. McFarland, but Shidler holds that there's got to be a benefit flowing in the opposite direction, whether it's the money that you're getting from shaking somebody down or physical property or something. The mere depriving A of something isn't enough unless B gets something in return. That was what that entire holding was about.
And if it would have gone all the way through and Mr. McFarland would have participated, they would have gotten what they wanted, but they didn't.
But they didn't want what Mr. McFarland... That's exactly what they didn't want. They didn't like, according to your theory, anything that Mr. McFarland had produced.
They wanted him to change his...
They didn't want what he'd done already, that's for sure.
That's
correct. They didn't really want his services, it seems, since they terminated him.
That's correct, and they purposely set out to use what he'd already, you know, partially use his appraisals by...
Why were they his appraisals anyway, if he was their employee?
Well,
he
was the employee of Marshall Stevens, the appraisal firm.
Right.
The law firm, after this had gone on for quite some time, realized McFarland was going to play ball. They could have started all over with another appraisal firm. They didn't. They moved McFarland aside. They picked up, changed his appraisals, and had someone else in the company sign off on it.
I know, but my question is, if this is all a conspiracy of these various entities, I don't know why Mr. McFarland has an ownership interest of any kind in the appraisals that he prepared as an employee of M&S. That's not the usual rule. I mean, even if it were copyright, it wouldn't be the usual rule. But certainly, in terms of things that an employee does for an employer, it's for the employer's benefit, and the employee gets a salary in return.
That's correct, but his career, the threats were not just, I'll remove you as an employee, I will ruin you as an appraiser in the St. Louis area.
Which may well be a state tort, but you need to get back to how that could possibly either be a Hobbs Act violation as a predicate offense to RICO or anything that doesn't, as my colleague Judge Rovner said, fall within the ambit of Beck.
Okay. And once again, I apologize to the court. Since the Hobbs Act was ignored by the trial court, this wasn't an issue thoroughly briefed on whether or not it meets the Hobbs Act. We were under the impression it did. We've alleged it. If the court finds that it doesn't fit the Hobbs Act requirement, then we would ask the court to look very carefully at the wording of the Supreme Court in Beck, where they say, or otherwise unlawful under RICO. If it's not a predicate act and it's somehow otherwise tortious under RICO, what can it be? Our theory is, and our proffer to you would be, the only other thing it could be is the agreement itself. We believe that if you have a specific conspiracy agreement which includes a provision to fire somebody, that agreement in and of itself under conspiracy law is illegal, and therefore an exception to the Beck holding, which they didn't analyze in their analysis of, you know, cause of action existing without the conspiracy agreement. So that's our position in this particular case. There's an exception to Beck, and that is their specific agreement that included, they had to make a new agreement with Marshall and Stevens to get rid of McFarland, was there itself an agreement that was illegal, and therefore Mr. McFarland's termination pursuant to that agreement is a RICO violation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coggan. Ms. Singley?
May it please the court, Emily Singley on behalf of one of the defendants, Marshall and Stevens. To the extent that counsel is arguing a second conspiracy theory, he is suggesting a separate conspiracy to remove and terminate Mr. McFarland. Under that scenario, the alleged Hobbs Act violation is entirely irrelevant because a conspiracy to terminate someone is not unlawful under RICO.
Well, let's pursue this extortion thing. Suppose you had incriminating photographs of Judge Rovner eating an endangered species.
That would be you.
And Judge Rovner went to you and threatened you and said, you know, you must give her the photographs or she will, you know, have you disbarred. And so you yield to the threat and you give her the photographs, and of course she then destroys them. So wouldn't that be extortion? That is, she's taking something from you, which really has no value to her. She wants to destroy it, but nevertheless, she is taking something. And so isn't it, so you could draw an analogy and say, well, they're taking McFarland's employment.
Right. That's what he's trying to argue. But the crucial point here is he's not asserting a substantive violation of the Hobbs Act. He's asserting a conspiracy to violate RICO. And that's where Beck is exactly on point, and that's where we have to consider the Holmes proximate cause analysis of whether or not the ultimate injury that he suffered, which was the loss of his employment, is directly related to the alleged illegal conduct. And there's a disconnect there. It's different from your example.
What remedy does a whistler, a whistleblower have in this situation? I mean, what cause of action could he have brought if we take as true the facts that he alleged in the complaint?
A wrongful termination cause of action in state court.
I assume the reason he doesn't want to do that is because there are no attorney's fees or treble damages.
But I can't speculate on that, but yeah, there wouldn't be. But there certainly are available remedies in state court and under common law for the type of activity that he's alleging.
And defamation, I assume.
Certainly for defamation. And it appears that his Hobbs Act claim sounds more of either coercion or defamation. And coercion is not actionable under RICO, and defamation certainly is not. Plaintiff's allegation that he was penalized for refusing to yield to an attempted extortion is virtually indistinguishable from the plaintiff in Beck's claim that he was penalized for refusing to join an unlawful scheme. Plaintiff's approach would in fact do away with Beck in any case where there's a threat to terminate before an actual termination. Many cases arising under the Beck scenario could essentially be pled in the manner that plaintiff is proposing. In any event, he has not alleged a Hobbs Act violation. He alleges that defendants threatened to email every law firm in St. Louis and attempt to ruin his career. And those allegations fall far short of establishing that they obtained anything from him using actual or threatened force, violence, or fear as required under the Hobbs Act. The requirement that property must be obtained is necessary to distinguish an extortion claim from a coercion claim. But even if the court finds that these threats state a claim for extortion, plaintiff fails to allege any resulting damages to his business or property so that he could recover under RICO.
Well, he does. Actually, he alleges, taking this in the light most favorable to him, that his entire career has been ruined. I mean, surely that's enough of an allegation of damage to his business or property.
Well, damages to reputation.
You don't have to, in federal court, you don't have to give a particular monetary amount. Maybe you do in state court, but you don't have to in federal court.
But damages to a reputation standing alone are not business damages to business or property sufficient to confer RICO standing.
But it's his career. It's his business, as it were, that he's saying has been destroyed.
But if we were to accept that damage to injury alone or damage to reputation alone is a sufficient injury, then every defamation claim...
Well, it's business reputation. Nobody's saying he's sleeping with the wrong person or anything. It's his business reputation.
But that would still open the doors for a defamation claim to be brought under RICO.
Well, but when businesses sue for defamation, aren't they suing for a business loss?
Yes, but they don't sue under RICO. That's the distinction.
No, but if all the other requirements of RICO were satisfied...
I don't believe that all the requirements are satisfied. Even if we get through the damages and assume that there are damages under the extortion statute, there is no proximate cause for purposes of RICO conspiracy liability. And the Holmes test comes into play at that point. There's no direct nexus between the illegal conduct that defendants are charged with and the ultimate injury to plaintiff. It's inconceivable that this conspiracy was formed for the sole purpose of terminating plaintiff. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Singley. Mr. Unrath?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Craig Unrath. I represent, among others, Paul Weil.
And was Mr. Weil part of that motion?
Yes, he was. I'd like to assure the court of that fact that we do have a final order. I wish I had a copy of that motion to dismiss with me, but I do not.
Well, that's all right. If it's in the record, we will see it.
I can assure you that the first thing I do when I return to the office is to look at that. co-counsel suggested that there's a disconnect between the RICO allegations and the termination of Mr. McFarland. I'd like to explore that a little bit. Under RICO, we do have a proximate cause requirement. The conduct constituting the predicate acts under RICO must cause the injury. Now, I'd like to ask the court to consider one possibility. What if Mr. McFarland had not been fired? What would have happened? Would the conspiracy have gone down in flames? Would they have been dragged off in chains? Or, just as it happened, did we just file this so-called fraudulent tax return while he was on the job? What effect did it have? And this goes to a very crucial point. He can only claim injuries for damages incurred by acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. How did this possibly further our conspiracy? We had a job out there to defraud the government of much-needed revenue. Now, apparently,
I assume you're scrupulously following the Rule 12b-6 rules.
Oh, I am definitely following rule, assuming that all facts are taken as true. So we have our conspirators here, and one of them looks up and says, the first thing we have to do is we have to eliminate McFarland discreetly. And all I can think of is the other conspirators looking at him and saying, why? How does that help us? We have a tax return that's all set to go. We have another appraiser that's already signed. It's ready to put in the mail. Indeed, McFarland is still on the job, apparently, when that tax return is filed. He was not terminated upon being reassigned to another case. He was terminated at some indefinite time in the future, so he's still there. He's still working at Marshall and Stevens. We file our fraudulent tax return. Conspiracy's over. We've defrauded the government. We're all wealthy now. What about why?
You're wealthy, but you're vindictive. And
well, yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, your point has to be that, yeah. That even if it's wrong or illegal for a firm to fire an employee who is an annoying gadfly who insists on truth and integrity, that's not a RICO violation. There may be other ways of getting at that.
If that firing him furthered our conspiracy, if this somehow helped us, well, it did just the opposite. Now, what do you do when you want
to... Why wouldn't it help you to get rid of somebody like that in that he might blow the whistle on you if he stays in the job? He'll keep learning more and more.
I can assure you that if you fire him, he's definitely going to blow the whistle. As I understand it, a self-respecting conspirator is not going to fire the guy. What they're going to do is buy him off. They're going to buy his silence. They're going to keep him quiet. They'll promote him. They're not going to fire him because
that's how they all got to be presidents and CEOs. Now I know.
This is business in America, or perhaps the world. I just don't get this case, and that's really what it comes down to. It just doesn't make sense that we would wait until after the tax return is filed, and then go back and say, we're going to get this guy. Now, maybe it was done out of malice or spite, and maybe you have a cause of action for wrongful termination there, but those are not RICO violations. We were not helped by this termination of Mr. McFarland. It doesn't make sense, and it does not satisfy the proximate causation requirement under RICO. Other point here is that Hobbs Act, there was some discussion of whether or not he was extorted. Now, I looked at a lot of extortion law, and it's very difficult to try to fit that in with this case. One way or the other, I seem to feel that before you can claim extortion, you have to get something of value.
Even the photographs of Judge Rovner?
I just don't know.
They hate me.
I just don't know if there's any value there. And we have to be enriched somehow.
Well, apparently they're very valuable to her if she's going to go to the trouble of getting them so that she can destroy them.
Under as I see it, though, even if we presume that there's an extortion here and a violation of Hobbs Act, it makes no difference for the simple reason that it didn't further our conspiracy. I ask that the decision be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Unrath. Mr. Goggin, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Briefly, I would say to the court, the original conspiracy that we've alleged in the complaint involved the law firm, and they were not going to include the appraisal firm. When Mr. McFarland became unwilling to satisfy Mr. Weil, then it's alleged they had to incorporate M&S into the agreement. They formed a new agreement, and it was at that point we're saying the wrong took place. They incorporated this scheme to get rid of McFarland. Whether it happened a year later, 18 months later, is kind of irrelevant for the purpose of reviewing our pleadings. We've pled that that in and of itself constituted a new conspiracy agreement to get rid of McFarland, and we think the resulting damages resulted from that, and we think we have proximate cause under Holmes related directly to that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Goggin and Ms. Singley and Mr. Unrath.